life's been so sweet to me.
Welcome to On Mindfulness. On Mindfulness is a show of the Shasta Resilience Project offered here on KKRN, Community Supported Radio. And on this show, we explore different ways of practicing mindfulness with practitioners, creative people, and others who find ways to incorporate mindfulness into their life. In the archives, you'll find a range of different modalities and also examples and exercises for you to try on and see what works for you. We're so glad you're here. On today's show, I have the great privilege and pleasure of speaking to Emma Richardson and Daniel Hill. And I'm going to let you all introduce yourselves. I usually do this with people so that you are highlighting what's important to you.
Yeah, my name's Daniel Hill. Just hit the ripe age of 30.
Woohoo.
And the quick story is I was born in San Jose. My parents moved me to Trinity County when I was 4, grew up in Weaverville and right over the hill from Redding here. Took off to the Bay Area for 4 years, transferred into UC Berkeley where I was studying environmental science. Taught as a second and third grade teacher for a couple years back in Trinity after that, before I moved to Redding right when COVID hit, and was kind of finding my ground. I knew I wanted to work in the arts. I was Lyft driving and Ubering and substitute teaching. And then I finally sort of just through dedication and determination, I've found myself now working for 2 nonprofit arts companies and, you know, side hustling as a musician. But now I wear a lot of artsy hats and am like grateful to be a part of the like this cultural wave that's happening in Redding. And I feel like I get to sort of like help incubate and support and be a part of it.
I could totally see you teaching second and third grade. They must have adored you.
That the best part of it was being in the room with the kids and you know, spending that time together. Where I knew it wasn't for me was I was going home and I didn't like, lesson planning wasn't calling to me. I wasn't like really necessarily excited to get up and be a teacher every day. Of course, when I got in the room, the energy was infectious and
yeah,
the kids
yeah.
were amazing, but I knew I wanted to. I was also like simultaneously commuting to Reading to be in Rocky Horror. And I was like, in these cool arts culture places and just like surrounded by like-minded people that just like so infectious. And the teaching is still, it's still a part of me. I just actually finished up. I was teaching guitar lessons out at Juvenile Hall here in Reading. I could feel a lot of those old teacher habits coming back and supporting me in that environment. And I find myself teaching even when directing a show or things like
sure.
that. Like it's all still there.
Emma, what about you?
I'm Emma Richardson. I'm going to follow Daniel's template here. I was born in North Carolina. My family's from like the Southeast, and we moved to Reading when I was 7. We were in a really religious environment at the time, and then have my whole family's kind of left that now. But grew up in Reading. Doing theater in Reading, being a little artist, was always really drawn to the arts and being creative in that way, and really fell in love with theater in particular, and then left for college. I went to Southern Oregon University and got my BFA in theater performance, and then through kind of some weird happenstance friends of friends thing, got a job directing at Axiom Repertory Theater. And then really kind of fell back in love with my hometown, kind of looking at it from a completely different side of it, and made the decision to move back. And so I've been back in Reading for like 3 years now. I think it was just 3 years. And I've been writing music and directing shows and being in shows, and just generally being a little artist around.
Yeah, well, and as someone who's not in theater, the Ashland seems to be such a vibrant place to be. I mean, what was that like to be in the program and to be so close to that Shakespeare theater?
It's the perfect place to cut your teeth because there's theater everywhere all the time. And so I got to see you know, not only incredible professional shows that are being put on by theaters like the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and the Oregon Cabaret, just great theaters up there, but also a part of really weird theater that me and my friends were putting on in school, and just the freedom to feel like we could all really try stuff all the time. And we made so much weird art together. It was really beautiful. One of my favorite things I've ever directed, my friend Jenny Babish, she wrote a play called Frog and Toad Are on the Verge of Divorce, and it was a 25-minute one-act play that I had the privilege of directing, and it's still like one of my favorite pieces of art I've ever made. It was so much fun, and yeah, we did it for a 24-hour play festival, and we just got to do weird try it out stuff all the time. Felt like we were in a sandbox, and so it's a perfect place to kind of figure out your own artistic identity.
Yeah, well, that's a theme that's throughout these questions, and we may get to it more specifically, but just that idea of that spirit of playfulness bringing to creative pursuits, and what we have to let go to do that, and what we have to call up to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's sparking a lot of ideas. Em and I, we started a band a year or two ago, and we have a whiteboard at home, and it's just like, be loud, have fun, make noises, you know, because like so often we're like starting to like play music, and it's easy to sort of shy away from the energy and have something that's a little more comfortable and familiar, something that doesn't like push the boundaries a bit more. But when we're having the most fun, it's when we just sort of let it go and see what happens and play within that. And
do you find it the audience really responds to that?
Always. I think audiences, like intrinsically in our human kind of lizard evolution brains, can tell when you're lying. They can tell when you're lying. And so audiences really respond the most to honest emotion and honest experiences. And I think the easiest way to get people there is through play. I found it the most when learning about how to clown, which I talk about clowning all the time, but I love clowning, and I think it's the best way to free up an artist of like just being honest and vulnerable, and people really respond to that, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, there does seem to be a real hunger for that. You both mentioned some of the things you do, but you both are engaged in multiple creative pursuits, so if you can remember them all.
I'm lucky that all of my jobs are rooted in the arts. A big part of what I do and spend my time working is sort of helping facilitate other people's artistic dreams, providing spaces, setting up equipment.
Sound, but you do sound.
Sound, yeah. I also, theatrically, I do a lot of acting, which is fun. I've also been dipping into directing. I've directed two theatrical productions, which I think really did a good job of bringing the script alive and putting it on stage. And I've had great teams doing that. And then also still on the theatrical side, but also sometimes on the music side, live sound engineering and lighting. Mm. I've had the privilege of learning from some great lighting designers in town, Pete Bilton and Alex Hoff-Belden. They both sort of showed me the ropes and sound engineering. I've learned a lot from Robert Ward and my friend Jacob Bacana, and just plenty of people I've met along the way. And then I also like being on the other side of that. I, you know, play in some local bands and have a couple of my own. I also play, like, I was playing music at the farmer's market yesterday or the day before. Fun. And that was really fun. And I like to get my hands dirty too. Like, you know, I do a little bit of painting. I think I got them all. Mainly music and theater. Those are the big ones for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I signed on to be in a friend's doing a short film. My friend Tyler Lockamy, who runs co-runs the Shasta Media Coalition in town and puts on the Sundial Film Festival. He's doing a short film, and I've been talking to him. So I'm in my first foray into the movies, which will be fun.
Yeah, I would say do theater in town. I act and direct at Axiom. I'm also their technical director, so I organize the tech teams for them and make sure that there's crew and lighting operators to make shows run smoothly. And then I guess I'm also technically a poet. I sometimes bristle at being called that, but I think enough time has passed now that that is true.
So, I think that is true.
Yeah. And then, Daniel and I are in a band. We write all the songs together and I sing and Yeah, I think that's everything.
It's been really, just talking about doing the music together, it's been really fun. We'll like have like a shared note on our phone and I'll send her lyrics and then I'll look at the page a little later and they're edited and we just kind of keep bouncing off each other and it's been super fun.
What I'm hearing is like willingness to, or attraction to trying new things too, you know, whether it's film or slam, you know, mm-hmm. poetry or learning about lighting, and which is a creative in itself, right? Lighting and sound and how you do that. Earlier, you mentioned, Daniel, that, you know, there's this cultural wave here. And so I'm wondering, since you've both come back in particular, what about what's available here has helped shaped your creative growth or opportunities?
I think there's something to be said about, you know, people talk like big fish, small pond, small fish, big pond, yada, yada. But I do think the pond here is a really good size. When I was living in Berkeley, and albeit I was much younger, it was a little overwhelming. Culture for days, cool people for day. Every corner you turn, there's another artist that's awesome. But I had a hard time getting gigs, you know, I had a hard time getting those opportunities to take the stage and kind of shoot my shot a little bit. Here there's been a lot more opportunity. I feel like I could have a gig every week if I wanted to. There's just a lot of shops that have spaces for performers and especially working at the Arts Council for the last few years, I've sort of gotten to know the movers and shakers around town. It feels like there is a little less competition. There's still an air of competition if you want it, but it feels very collaborative here. Mm-hmm. And I sense the collaboration growing more and more. And I do think a lot of it is working at the Arts Council, and we formed all these coalitions. Like there's a theater coalition, and monthly all the theaters meet together. And it didn't used to be like that. There used to be this kind of competitive vibe. But now you have all these sort of leaders coming together and being like, hey, what's up? What kind of help do you need? And there is still an air of competitiveness sometimes, be it actors fighting for parts or competing or whatever. But I think the more that from the top down, the executive directors and the CEOs and stuff, the more we sort of just prioritize community and collaboration, it'll just keep trickling down before we all realize rising tide floats all boats and theater's a lot more fun when you're focusing on bringing a show to life and working together than trying to be number one on the call sheet.
I also think there's something really special about being in a place that is developing its cultural scene, like being on the ground floor of a place that I know so well and that didn't used to be like this, but you can feel this like artistic cultural change that's really, really happening kind of post-COVID, which is miraculous because I feel like the opposite has happened in more metropolitan areas. Post-COVID, their arts and culture has kind of taken a hit, and it feels like Reading is blossoming and blooming, this beautiful art scene post-COVID, and being able to be a part of that is like such a dream.
You know, one of the things that you're making me think about, you know, I spoke to Carlo Henry at the Art Hunger about, you know, his vision for bringing in, being inclusive and bringing in a lot of different visual artists. So I'm wondering if there's something about the inclusivity, is there something about the hunger that people have for something more? You know, what else is kind of driving some of the innovation that we have that is kind of surprising when you look at other ways that we roll?
I think the power of counterculture is really strong. When you feel like you aren't represented or don't exist in a mainstream culture, your desire for community is going to grow exponentially within you because you're going to be extra hungry for all of that stuff. And it's actually crazy that our little town has so many local community theaters. That is, it's wild that it's not zero, let alone five that we have. Yeah. And so I think people in our community really crave to be together really crave community, and they really crave to make something together. And that is like a unique thing that art can give to us. And and it's countercultural, which people are really drawn to, I think, when you don't feel represented by mainstream culture.
I think the countercultural aspect is massive, and I do see it sort of manifesting in a lot of ways. And I've kind of had the privilege, again, sort of helping facilitate programs and events and stuff. We're doing drag shows monthly that are just killer, and just getting to know these people and make new friends. And then, you know, seeing like my friend Hades, auditioned for a stage play at Riverfront and totally kicked butt up there. And it's just, I don't know. It's cool to see like trans men get representation in theater and stuff. And I don't know how prominent that was a few years ago.
Sure.
And I think, you know, the more that these shows exist, the more that venues make space, the more that we like bring people together and be like, actually, yeah, you totally are supported. Then like, yeah, you'll see people turning up. You're going to have way more diverse audition rooms. If people that haven't usually been represented on stage are getting opportunities, they're going to be like, oh, this is an option. And now all of a sudden when you're auditioning a show, you're going to have a beautiful swath of people to choose from instead of just, you know, what we're used to.
Right. The same people.
Yeah.
So you probably get asked this question a lot, but I'm really interested in what are your sources of inspiration and how often you go to those explicitly. You know, what's your process? Because I can think of for writing, there's some that I need to be in nature, and I do that with intention, and other things that are more passive that wind up inspiring me. So I'm wondering what are your go-tos and what you're kind of cultivating.
I think I've the last couple years I've sort of taken on a more passive inspiration approach. I think I used to be very product oriented. Finish a song and then you have a song. And I, you know, was always kind of looking to start something and finish it. I think I just got so busy, that I was sort of too tired to force something or just search for the inspiration. Some of my favorite lyrics and songs that I'm writing happen sort of just on the way to work or during a break, or I'm going to the bathroom and I hear a melody in my head and it's like, I gotta write that down, you know? And I think sort of just not forcing it for me and letting it be passive and taking it when I get it. And then I know we're going to talk about collaboration, but then having, you know, a friend to send it to and be like, hey, what do you think? That sort of sparks it. And it's taken a lot of pressure off of me. The things that I 100% do are the things that are on my calendar, and it's usually work or a band practice or whatever. And those are sort of when I'm muscling through it and kind of allowing for those opportunities to exist just by getting it on the calendar and showing up. But my favorite sort of personal inspiration for the stuff that I'm working on that I just like to do, I just sort of let it come when it comes. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain,
I'm the exact opposite. and that's why it's making me laugh. I am an anxious person and an overthinker kind of just by nature. And so I, when it comes to my art, take a deeply intellectual approach where I think probably too hard about the thing that I'm making before I even put pen to paper. When Daniel and I write songs together, I struggle sometimes we have with collaboration is I'm like, I need to sit with this for 2 days before I can even start writing something down. And Daniel is so of the moment in a way that is beautiful and wonderful, but just is not how my brain operates at all. And so I find inspiration everywhere all the time, but I have to think about it and stew with it and sit with it for so long before I can even start. I also really take the write what you know to heart. And so the questions I ask myself when I'm writing something or directing something are, what do I know? what do I need to know? And like the gap between those two things. But again, it's very, I call myself a wizard because I like pore over books and things before I do anything. It's very, very intellectual, very in my head sort of artistic process.
It's so true. You'll post a poem or something and I'm like, that's incredible. Did you write that today? And you're like, yeah, I wrote it today, but I've been thinking about it for a month. And that blows my mind because yeah, when I get a song, it's just there, you know. I don't really, yeah. I don't plan. I don't have concepts.
Yeah, I like chew on, especially when it comes to poetry, I like chew, there'll be like a word or a phrase that grabs my attention that someone I love said, and I like chew on it for sometimes up to like a month before I even start writing anything. Yeah, it's long.
Yeah, well, we definitely have our own processes. As an overthinker myself, I really, yeah, I resonate with that. Is you're both in these milieu, right? Like you're constantly surrounded by different kinds of art. So like you work across from a gallery, you know, you have these actors and scripts. And so those, I'm sure, inspire as well that not everyone has access to.
Yeah.
We even went to a concert last weekend that I feel like is still inspiring me now. Yeah, so it's just stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Nice. What are your earliest memories of performing, and any kind of performing?
For Christmas one year, my dad got me like a little toy, like Fisher-Price light-up guitar. And I would just write songs and put on like boas and sunglasses and come out and perform them for my dad. He still remembers some of them and will torment me with them when I visit. But yeah, I've always been a little clown ham just out doing jazz hands in front of everybody.
My sister Melody and I, we would write songs in the backseat of the car when we were going on family trips. And then we'd get to the hotel and we'd perform it for them. Or, you know, we'd... and then I also remember in third grade, we did the Nutcracker for our school play. And I remember performing in that. I can still just see, I can just visualize being on the stage and looking out at the auditorium. And I mean, how old are you in third grade?
Seven or eight.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's 20 plus years ago, and I can still conjure up that memory. It was so exciting.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to On Mindfulness on KKRN Community Supported Radio, and I'm in conversation with Emma Richardson and Daniel Hill. Given that you perform in different, you're engaged in different art forms, I'm wondering how that engagement informs your other forms of creativity. How does it help you or otherwise shape what you do?
I think theater has transformed everything for me. And it's not theater in the sense of acting in a show. It's theater in the sense of what does it take to run one from the top to the bottom and have it be ethical and collaborative and still focus on the art. When I used to make music, it was like, what's it going to take for this thing to go viral? Or the dream of I want to go on tour with a band. It's easy to dream it up. It's easy to think about, hey, if I write a good song, maybe I'll be famous. But you do you look at a theatrical enterprise and you look at the spreadsheet for what it takes to put on a show. You have all your actors, but then you have your director and your assistant director and your scenic designer and your lighting designer and your costume designer and your stage hands and your producer. And then chances are the theater has a board with a financial officer and your head of house, and the list just goes on and it never seems to stop. And even then, it's hard to sell enough seats and make enough money to reinvest it in to do the next one. We just went and saw a band, and you have your five musicians up there,
but you have $1 million lighting rig behind him, and you have techs coming out and swapping guitars all the time. And as soon as the show was over, you saw the stage flooded with people that are tearing it all down to pack it into vans to take it to another venue to set it all up. And it's like, sure, you want to take your band on tour, but it's not about you. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with theater. You want to act in a show. Cool. A show needs actors and a band needs a performer. But when you're really doing it right, it's not about you. And like when you go to perform, yeah, you're performing. But like, what about the 1,000 people in the audience? And like, I think the greatest shows I've been to, it's when you all feel like you're one and you get lost and you're just grateful and you're so happy that they're playing. And it's a really strange paradigm that you have to work in when you're like an actor or when you're a performer, because you need to focus on yourself. You need to come prepared. You need to do all that. But the greatest thing I've learned from theater is that, yeah, you got to take your individual accountability, but you also need to be able to let it all go and recognize that it's a complex combination of so many people coming together. Even just on the show end, then you weave in the audience, the whole kind of reason you're doing it, to provide a safe place to come together for entertainment. I think the biggest thing I've learned is just to shed the ego, show up prepared, do what you got to do, fill your role, but also know that it goes so far beyond any single individual. Mm. And if you're looking for success, you should be looking for a solid team. Yeah. You shouldn't be caught up in just yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think art is a really fascinating way to like engage with ego at all. Because I agree with Daniel completely. Theater is so deeply collaborative, and the best. I know I have done a good job as a director when I know my actors can listen to each other and really care about each other. And they don't need to love each other off stage. But if I've created an environment where we care enough about the show being good and they care about each other enough to make the show good, then I've done a good job, right? As a leader of that space. What I love about other forms of art, like painting or poetry, is I get to be a little bit selfish in a way that theater doesn't allow, where the poem I write is I write it for me first. And an audience of people happen to read it and respond to it, and that's wonderful. But that is a way I get to engage with some like more selfish parts of my ego. And so all forms of art, I think, allow us to engage with different aspects of ego in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I'm hearing from both of you, maybe your visual art or writing, you're connecting with yourself and speaking a truth, let's just say, for you. And the theater's more, it's bigger than you.
Yes.
Yeah. Which seems, and you're connecting to that. And that also seems like it could be freeing. Is it for you?
I think so. I have a big love of the classics. I love Greek theater. I love Shakespeare. I love really old plays that no one's ever heard of. Those are my favorites. And part of why I love them is it's one of the only times I still feel spiritual or religious is when I'm performing words that have been performed for hundreds of years that like feel so much bigger than me and does feel so freeing. It's almost like a safety net to fall on, where it's like, I know these words and this script has been performed for hundreds of years. This script has got me. And then I just get to focus on making this stuff with the people in the room that I'm making it with.
Mm. So let's talk about collaboration. And, you know, even in theater, I'm guessing there are people who do not collaborate. I'm guessing you probably have encountered, you know, some of those. But there's so much power, like you were saying, in collaboration and so many unexpected things that could happen. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your definition of collaboration, you know, what it is to you, what you like about it, what might be challenging about it, all those things.
I think the most challenging part of collaboration is like maybe when you just like disagree with your collaborators, but then you have to recognize the system you're in. Like with theater, there can be issues with collaboration, but it is organized from a top down approach. Like your director sits at the top, and a lot of directors don't want to be at the top. It's just what do you call it? When I'm a director, it's like I'm sitting at the top and I don't want to be like, hey, I'm at the top and this is how it goes. But when there are issues with collaboration, or when questions arise, or when something comes up, at least you know where to look. And if you're prepared enough and you've thought about it enough and you know how to work with people enough, you can sort of address it. I know I just went straight to the challenges of collaboration.
No, that's great. Get it out of the way. Well, let's see, Emma, what's challenging for you? And then we'll get to
I think that's it. I, despite being an anxious overthinker, I am not a conflict averse person. So often, like, as challenging as disagreeing is, especially when you're an actor and you disagree with a fellow actor, that's something that you kind of keep to yourself, and you go home and you're like, oh my God, can you believe? But when you're in the room, that's not your job, it's the director's job. So as a director, which is when you deal more with like the direct conflict, it can provide something really beautiful where it's like, we disagree. Why do we disagree? Let's talk about why we disagree. And we can hopefully find somewhere we do agree, and then we can work from that place. Or you sometimes just have someone who's really, really stubborn, and that's hard. And I always tell my actors, I have veto power. I love you and I love your ideas and I want you to bring them to the table, but I do get final say. I do get to veto. And some people respond better to that mm-hmm. than other people do, and that can be tough for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can see like in a classroom where it can provide that container, that's important, that safety.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. So what is generative for you about collaboration in general?
I think using two actors on stage is a great example for what collaboration can look like. Just thinking about there's an old adage in theater that goes around writing a lot: acting is reacting. Some people will say that the only acting that has to happen in a show is the very first line, and everything after that is simply reacting off of what you've heard. So much of theater. Ken Hill loves to say theater is more than the recitation of memorized lines. So as an actor, ideally you show up prepared, you know all your lines, but then you also free yourself up to when someone's giving you a line, your cue line, you're going to talk next. You don't just wait for them to finish your line and say yours. You listen and you experience the feeling, you experience what they give you, and then through your thoughts, through what you take in, the only thing your character could say in that moment is what your line is. You couldn't say anything else because you hear what they say. But
that's really, I mean, what I hear, it's really being present, mm-hmm. right? Like really being present to the moment and to who you are playing.
Yeah. And if you're present and you're present with your scene partner, they may change their inflection as the rehearsal mm-hmm. processes go on. They may put emphasis on a different word. They may say their line from a different place. And unless you're being collaborative as a scene partner in the moment, actively listening and giving them that space to share their energy with you, you have to do that. You have to be collaborative. And then if you do, then it's going to invoke a new emotion in you. And then your line may come out differently. And then if they're listening to you, they may feel that energy. And then their line comes out differently. You're still going to be saying the same lines because you're prepared and you're following a script usually. But then it starts taking on that air of verisimilitude. It starts giving that illusion of life and truth and realness because you're actually playing with emotions and you're listening. That's sort of the essence of theatrical actor collaboration to me. Otherwise you're just saying your lines and it's like, well, what are we doing here? You know,
mm-hmm. My favorite part of collaboration is being surprised, like in any aspect, whether I'm acting or directing, it's so fun to feel like you know something so well. I know how this person's going to say this line, how the scene's going to look, and then to be completely surprised and now have a completely new idea for what a scene can look like as a director. That's like pure magic. Oh my God, I had no, that was not even in a corner of my mind until this other person brought their perception of this scene. And now I get to look at this scene entirely differently. That's such a gift. That's my favorite, is just other people's brains bring lots of fun surprises, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything about collaborating with each other on your band? Which you please promote.
Yeah. The Yips. We're on Instagram. The Yips with a Z.
YIPZ exclamation point. We're working on recording an album, and that'll take some time. We're just so busy, and we're not really rushing it. But the songs are good. We keep writing new songs. But I think when we first started writing songs together, we were just sitting in the studio, and I was like, let's do a song. And I, you know, played a bass line, and Emma and started building out a song, and Emma was writing lyrics on the couch sort of to herself. And she's like, all right, I'm ready to try something. And then she plugged in the microphone and she sang a little bit over the music we recorded. And I was like, that's really cool. You can do that. Whoa. And so that's sort of where we kind of both realized we could both do these things and bring them together. But then a few songs later, we kind of kept that process. But a few songs later, I think I was hitting a music block and Emma was hitting a sort of a writing block. And we're like, well, what if we kind of combined a little bit? And so we started tag teaming the lyrics together and kind of working on the music a little more together. And all of a sudden, when we finished that song, we listened back to it and we said, this is 10x better than everything else we've written up till this point. We should be writing together more.
This is the way we should be writing now. And it's, I mean, we would listen to that song, that first one that we wrote, like really and truly in tandem, and then go back and listen to old ones. And we were like, why does this just not sound as good? And I think it is just, two heads are often truly just better than one. You just have, you know, you get your expertise and another person's expertise, and those two compound to make something that is just better than you could have made by yourself.
And now we have two other band members, and occasionally we get together. And I know once this album starts getting pieced together, we have the songs in our heads, but I have some idea, but I'm just so excited to hear what it sounds like once, because I could never play drums as good as Danny Wasaki. He's playing out at the Vans Warped Tour right now. I'm like, how cool is it that our drummer's playing at a giant festival?
And it's so fun bringing those songs to band practice and just Dan and Chris, our bass player and our drummer, just mess around, and it's like, oh my gosh, that sounds so cool. Yeah. And you did something that we didn't plan, and how again, being surprised. I love this.
They'll text us, like, we'll send them a demo and they're like, I've played along to it 10 times. Like, I'm like, you didn't have to. Like, it's so cool that other people are inspired and adding in their stuff.
Well, what makes a collaboration good or healthy for you? And I'm thinking about, like, what do you do to foster a good or healthy collaboration, not just, you know, with each other, but in general?
I think collaborating with other artists is a lot like being in a relationship, where if your collaboration as artist starts to become codependent, it stops being good. It is really, really important in artistic collaboration that everyone involved remains an individual, because if we start thinking homogeneously, why are we collaborating at all? So I think creating a space where people feel comfortable to disagree, that's a big one, that there's no my way or the highway kind of anybody. And, you know, you can, if it's theater, like we talked about, you can establish, I think, some laws of veto in there. But it's important, I think, that everybody feels. In my house growing up, my dad used to say we'd have family meetings, and the rule in my house was my parents had a vote, but the kids always had a voice. So we were always allowed to vocalize our opinions about things that were going on with our family, but we didn't get final say. But our voices were taken into account for my parents' vote. And I feel that way to some extent about certain artistic partnerships. Mm-hmm. Ideally, everybody has a vote, but in situations where that's not possible, hopefully everyone at least has a voice.
But you're also saying, like, it's clear. There's clarity and people know what to expect.
Yeah.
There's no hidden, like, oh, just kidding, I'm in charge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And you'll get that. Not every
directors created equal, you know. One of my favorite Rick Rubin, great music producer, super famous guy, but he writes about sort of the ways you can get to a finished product. And let's say you're the one in charge. He's like, you can get a finished product employing the most devious methods or the most altruistic methods. Like, you could yell at someone and kick and scream and say, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it now, do it this way. They may eventually do it and you'll have a product. You could also take the complete opposite approach, find whatever's the most ethical, nice, kind way, and you'll, and you could also get a result from that. So you can get a result. You can finish your art. You can put up a piece. You can get to the end and you can say, hey, look, I did it. But the path in which you get there, those can look very different. And I think Emma and I both take pride in sort of the rooms that we cultivate. People leave being like, whoa, that was, I haven't felt that before. What a great room. Like I'd do it again, you know? And that's sort of, that's what I want to do, man. Like that's all I want to do is I want people to leave being like, yes, net positive, and I was taken care of.
And I've been thinking a lot lately, just with the kind of AI of it all in the background of all of this, about what art is actually. What is it? And I keep coming back to, it is the process. And so if the process is awful, then the finished product doesn't really matter. And so, yeah, it's really important to me to, especially in rooms where I am in charge, to create rooms that are really, really safe and feel good to be in. That doesn't mean they're not challenging. In fact, ideally they are, but that they feel good and safe to be a part of and in.
You're listening to On Mindfulness and my conversation with Emma Richardson and Daniel Hill. So one of the, we spoke about presence and the importance of presence and being open to opportunities. And one of the things, and you mentioned that you guys are always so busy, right? When one is engaged in mindfulness, right? There's this whole question of when you're aware, what do you say yes to and what do you say no to? And so I'm wondering at this stage, because it can change over time, how you all think about when to say yes to something. You know, what are your criteria, or how do you know this is going to be a yes, given the other things you're doing?
I'd say the more you know about the rooms you're entering into that you say yes to, the more sort of, it's kind of like knowledge is power. There might be 10 different shows you can audition through throughout the year, with 10 different directors and 10 different crews and line sheets of people that are going to be present. If you know people that are going to be in those rooms and you've had good experiences with them in the past, and you can trust and believe in those rooms, those are probably the rooms you want to sign up for and say yes to. If you're coming in to this area and you don't really know anybody, you might take some chances on some shows. What if you sign up for a room with someone who takes like a sort of yell at you approach to directing? You might not know that before you go in. If you get burnt a little bit, then you would know to say no to them next time and find different rooms that would take better care of you if you said yes to them. I got a text from a guy I'd met a couple years ago who wanted to book another studio session and record some music. And in the text he was saying like, hey man, like, I'm going to make you famous. This is going to be big. I have these great songs. And kind of going back to what I was mentioning earlier, like what it takes to take a band on tour, like the amount of the team and the trust that's necessary to like put on a good production that pays itself off and works. I was like, homie, you're like, yeah, we met a couple years ago and I was like, yeah, come on up. And we made some songs and it was fun. But like, I said no to the guy. No, I can't work with you, because it was all about, we're going to get famous, we're going to make it big, let's record this song. And so I know better now to say, nah, that's not what it's about for me. Mm-hmm. Like, good luck. I referred him to some people, but that'll record for him. But
That's what the community. It's the community or the people that you're saying yes to.
Yeah, yeah. It's more of that. Yeah, community and people. I agreed to do this to act in this movie with my friend Tyler Lockamy. It's not a paying gig. I've applied to, you know, I've auditioned for some movies that were paying gigs that seemed cool and didn't get them. And I don't really have a lot of free time to take on, you know, non-paying work. But Tyler Lockamy, I've acted in plays with him. I've gone over to his house. We've had dinner. We've hung out. We've watched the fireworks or something, you know. And so he's putting on a movie, and I know the guy, and I know he's got good equipment and a good team. And I read his script and I liked it. And I'm like, I would love to act for free and learn and be a part of this and stretch and grow and try a new medium. So that was one I said yes to. And that's not for everybody. There are some people that probably see themselves as an actor and they'd be looking for paying gigs. They should probably say no to that movie. But for me, I've never done this before and I trust the guy. So it's like, yeah. Heck yeah.
What about you?
I think I used to view my no's as more powerful than my yes. Like, no was like putting a wall up and yes was like rolling over, like, yes, whatever. And lately I've started to view them as equally powerful. Like, my yes is just as powerful as the no. And that has changed a lot. It's made me do a lot more things that I wouldn't think I would have done before. Like, honestly, going to as many like poetry workshops as I've gone to lately, that would have not been a yes for me probably a couple years ago. But it does always, I think, come back to community. Finding places that where there are people that are driving with you and like doing stuff that you want to be a part of, I think is like the balm for everything going on right now, is putting yourself in rooms where you are challenged and pushed and also held. That is like, those are the things to be saying yes to, for sure. And there is some risk involved with that. You might go into a room thinking that you're gonna jive and it's gonna be really great, and then it's not, and it's like, okay, well, you've learned, and there's nothing wrong with that, I think.
Especially those communities that shift, right? I mean you might have a theater group that's pretty consistent, but in any one play, right, the configuration,
you can work with the same director six times and be in completely different casts every single time. And it really only takes one. Like, you can have 20 people on a list. If you have one person that's getting up to weird stuff, it can tank the whole thing. Like,
and that's when it becomes so important to make it about the art. And it's so easy to make it about this person is being weird and this person is ruining it for everybody. And that might be, even be true, but like, it's even more important in those instances to make it about the art.
Yeah.
So the flip side of that is knowing when to say no. And, you know, Emma, you were talking about the boundaries, and certainly, I mean, that's important too, right? The boundaries and protection and needing to have the trust there, like, you know, Daniel is saying. And sometimes the yeses means saying no to something else too. So how do you approach, like, how do you know that something is a no for you? Like, how much is instinctual and how much do you kind of tick through more logically or, you know, more cognitively?
I think I usually know I'm going to say no the second I'm asked, but I don't often actually say no until like 2 weeks later, because overthinker. I have to actually write out a pro and cons list to make sure, do I actually want to say no? Are we sure I want to say no to this? And all that good stuff. But I do think part of why often I would say now, I feel so lucky, the most often reason I say no now is out of respect for the people that are asking me, because I don't have time. And I don't want, ideally, I would say yes to a bunch of these things, but I literally just can't. I do not have the time. And I respect the artists that want to work with me enough to tell them, I don't have time for this, and you deserve more of my time than I can give you. And that is a really privileged place to be.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it's respect for yourself too, and just acknowledging when it might all be too much. And
yeah.
What about you, Daniel? How do you know when to say no to an opportunity? Like, you were just mentioning that one with Glitzy, you're going to be famous. And
I think I think having a really good calendar is important. I get a lot of no's just from being like, I can't. My calendar is comprehensive off of multiple jobs, my own personal schedule, and everything in between. It's always nice, especially if I'm unsure of something, it's nice if the calendar says no to begin with, because then it's really easy, like, no, I can't, my schedule's not free. But yeah, I think bringing it sort of back to the community again. I feel like I should probably still be saying no more. I think that's why I'm having trouble answering the question, is I think I still, even the guy that wrote me about wanting to make the song and be famous, there was probably a good, 10 texts between us where I was still considering it and being like, well, should I up my rates a little bit to make it worth it, And when I really should have just been like, nah, I'm not catching this vibe from the get-go. I was still kind of trying to make it work. Mm-hmm. It's nice having like a partner whose opinion I like trust and value so much, because I can, when I'm, I think a big part of how I say no is I go, hey, Emma, what do you think?
With and this specific thing, he did come to me and was like, I don't want to do this. I was like, then don't.
Right. That's the heart of the coaching enterprise. Like, you have the wisdom within you.
Yeah.
Don't have all the answers. I still struggle saying no. So if you're one of those people, you're not alone.
Right. So a lot of this, knowing whether to say yes or no, and so many of the responses reacting, that you were talking about, really benefits from kind of mindfulness practice. And so we often ask people that we are in conversation with if they have a practice, and in your case, it could be a song, it could be any kind of exercise that helps you to ground or settle, or maybe you use with others to help them ground or settle. And if so, if you'd like to share it with us.
I know mine. I put on Enya. I think it stems back to my preschool teacher, Mrs. Yoho. We would during nap time, we would bring out a stuffed animal plushie and she would put on Enya and Only Time would come on. And I think I would just dream and wake up feeling rested. So that's my go-to. It's put on Enya, take a bath and just swim in the sounds and chill for a bit.
I have a couple. There's one I do with my cast before we start rehearsal. I stole this from my acting teacher, Jackie Apodaca, who I adore. But she would have a start class with, we'd all go around in a circle and we would vocalize how we were feeling at the current moment. So the idea is that you don't plan ahead, but you wait for the circle to get to you and you analyze how I am actually I feeling in this moment. And she didn't want to hear like tired, hungry, bored, whatever. The idea was you kind of visualize or like anthropomorphize your feelings. Like I think I've said before, I feel like a shaken up Diet Coke can, something to that effect. And that's a really great way to start off rehearsal. It's like we're all acknowledging how we all feel right now. It's also good as a director to gauge how everybody's feeling. And then like in my personal life, I have obsessive compulsive disorder, so I am worrying all the time about being present and trying to figure out how to be present all the time forever. But I like anything like physical, so dancing is a great way to get me out of my head and back into my body, and I like doing that a lot. Like taking walks, getting up, moving my body, those are just good ways. I'm really bad at meditation. I have to like physicalize my mindfulness. And so those things are really helpful for me.
Yeah, we've talked on this show, there's in the mind body medicine like curriculum, there's a shaking and dancing, and you shake first, then you chill out, then you move to the music. And there's, I mean, even swaying. Yeah, I'm a mover as well. But there's lots of like Tai Chi, yoga. There's lots of ways to
if I'm out and about, like if like a night on the town with friends, if I'm ever in like a personal bathroom stall with a lock on it, if you wonder what I'm doing in there, why I'm taking so long, I'm actually standing in front of the mirror wiggling, just yeah, being yeah. a complete weirdo, being like, I'm alive, I can move, everything's fine. And then I'll come out and be like, hey, everybody. But I do a lot of mirror time, a lot of just reminding myself that you can just be as silly and weird as you want, and you don't have to just constantly wear this I'm a normal human mm-hmm. kind of thing. Like we are in a floating ball in the middle of space, and you know, we're always looking for aliens when I think, you know, we've been the aliens the whole time. And there is time to get really grounded and really human and really like really just like stuck in, but I think there's also we also need the freedom just to be little weird alien creatures and wiggle around and sort of take that pressure off of having to be so normal.
Yeah, I also think play and like silly goofiness is really important right now in this like cultural moment we're experiencing. I think it's actually the only way we're going to survive all of the doom is just by reminding ourselves that there's that life is fun, and life is actually I'm like an ethical hedonist sort of in my personal ethics, so I'm like, if you're having a good time and it feels good, then you should probably keep doing that. And I think like prioritizing pleasure is the way we're going to get out of this, and mm-hmm. reminding people that life is supposed to be enjoyed and we're supposed to have fun, it's supposed to feel good. I think that stuff like that is going to save us.
Yeah. Well, you definitely have a lot of social justice advocates and the Dalai Lama actually behind you. Yeah. that joy is resistance. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. Very much.
As we wrap up, is there anything else I should have asked you or anything else that you want to say to bring to this conversation or to share with people?
Mainly just like get involved. If you're thinking, if you've been thinking about, hey, maybe I want to do theater, check out the local theaters. I know Axiom has auditions, you know, I don't know when this is coming out, but early August, August 8th, 9th or something. Go to the Dip, go to Fratelli's, go to Temple Music, see these shows, meet these local people. They're living next door, down the street, downtown, on Shasta View. I mean, like, I don't know. Go see shows, go meet people, go get involved.
Yeah.
I think it's cliche to say, but I think that's true. I think isolation is like killing us right now, and the cure for that, I call them the scaries or my doomies, like the cure for them is like being with people and getting out and organizing. And there, if you love to crochet, you can find a crochet group here in Reading. Like there are communities for everything, and allowing people to like hold you and see you is gonna save you. And so yeah, getting out there, getting organized. Doesn't have to be on stage either. If you want to do tech crew or anything, my email is on the Axiom website. You can email me, we will get you hooked up. There's always a job. But just being and getting involved, I think.
Well, thank you both so much, and we'll put whatever you want to share on the show notes so that people can connect. You've been listening to On Mindfulness on KKRN. Thank you for listening, and share this episode with others if you enjoyed it. And if you feel so moved, please donate and support local community radio. Life's been so sweet to me. You've been listening to On Mindfulness on KKRN, community-supported radio. Our theme music is provided by Rachel Beck of Omnificent.